Good morning. See you later, gang. How's everyone doing? Got it. You know, we got a picnic today, so you're all invited right across the street. All right. Hey, we got massive half-pound hamburgers, because I know you people. Yes. So, but the problem is we only have 13 of them, so you might want to get over there quick. The rest of us will be eating quarter pounders. But no, we got a bunch of them, so it'll be awesome. All right. It's good to be here. Man, that was powerful worship. Sometimes I debate, should we keep going? Should we stop? Should we go? And then Chris did a great job. So thank you, buddy. Well, we're going to be studying for the next few weeks, next number of weeks, a series called Courageous Living in Turbulent Times. Oh, really? Are there any other types of times? And aren't all times turbulent? Because it often seems like we're either in a turbulent time, coming out of a turbulent time, or what? Heading towards a turbulent time. So it's always there in the pick, in the view of life. The word turbulent, as defined by the Oxford Dictionary, means this. It is a time that is characterized by conflict, by disorder, by confusion, and is the opposite of stable or calm. And there is only one way to get through a turbulent time, and that is to have courage to deal with it. But courage isn't a standalone thing. It has multiple streams that are attached to the ocean of courage that we need to deal with tough times. But you know, the truth is this. Not all times are turbulent. Sometimes are calm and smooth and just the regular goings-ons of life. But those are crucial times, for it is in the non-turbulent times that you gain the practice to handle the turbulent times. And that's what we're going to be focusing on today. You know, if we do not practice the self-discipline we need in the good times, we will never be able to exercise it in the hard times. It has to be taken deep into us. What you practice, you perfect. That doesn't mean all practice is good practice, but what you practice is what you are and what you will become in the times of turbulence. Courageous living is developed in the calm and relatively stable times of normal life. Jeremiah 12:5, as he prophesied way back 2,700 years ago to the people, and he saw in a time of peace how out of control they were living. And he knew, because God had revealed to him that a turbulent time was coming. In 12:5, he spoke this word to the people. He said, "If you have raced with men on foot and they have worn you out, how can you compete with horses? If you stumble in the safe country, how will you manage in the thickets of the Jordan?" In other words, if one cannot live courageously while he's just dealing with the normal, everyday people of life and things of life, how can he or she live courageously, live successfully, when they have to run with the horses of life, the horses of loss and trauma and tragedy and grief, and the big changes that take place, where we running as fast as we can during those times, we can still barely see the horses. We are out of control. If we can't live it in calm times, we are certainly destined for trouble in turbulent times. So the calm times of life are super important in the development of our character. Listen, courageous people can be counted on when the going is rough. Why? For they could be counted on when the going was easy. See, if you can be counted on when the going is easy, you can be counted on when the going is rough. When you can't be counted on when the going is easy, you certainly won't be counted on when the going gets rough. You can't handle what you have now, you can't handle the greater. Courageous people, keep moving in the face of major obstacles. Why? Because they have learned to keep moving in the face of small obstacles. Courageous people have learned to adapt and overcome what seems like insurmountable setbacks. Why? Because they have learned to adapt and overcome normal setbacks. Courageous people keep their convictions in tragedy because they have learned to keep their convictions in prosperity. And how do you do this? It's a thing called character. Character is said to be this. It is the stable and distinctive quality built in to an individual's life, which will determine his or her response regardless of circumstances. Character is the behavior that is typical of a person and is commonly called their moral strength. Moral strength is your ability to do right when you could easily do otherwise. When you can do right because it's the right thing to do, you have what's called moral strength. And secondly is this, your character is your reputation. Whatever you think of your character, your reputation is really the definition of your character. You know, ever have anybody do character references? When you go to get a job, what do they want? Three character references. They want to know what your reputation is with people that you've been hanging with previously. Multiple times, multiple places want character references. Your character reference is your reputation, which is your character. Well, if you want to get a better understanding of what character is, think of a person's characteristics. What are your characteristics? What are the things that characterize you? How would you characterize yourself, for example? Are you a dependable person, or are you inconsistent? Are you determined, or do you give up easily? Are you well organized, or are you known as chaotic? Are you humble or prideful? Would people consider you to be even-tempered or quick to anger? Are you self-controlled or emotionally and circumstantially controlled? That's your character. What would people say about you? That's who you really are. There are lots of questions like this we could ask about ourselves or others. And when we know the answers to those questions, we can then say we have a pretty good understanding of your own character or of someone else's character. When you can ask yourself questions about them, are they an honest person? Are they a trustworthy person? Am I trustworthy? When I can answer that, I can actually define my character because we know our characteristics. Why is this important? Why take up some time in your life to look at this? And this is the reason, because character is the number one determining factor in your and my individual success. It is the most important factor in whether or not we will be successful, no matter what area of life we are talking about. Vocational, educational, relationships, financial, physical, spiritual. For example, it is certainly easy to say that a person who is diligent is much more likely to have success than a person who is slothful. We can come up with lots of those examples. But when we have learned this truth, that character is the determining factor for a person being successful, and to handle turbulent times, the character trait of courageous changes and defines everything. And we have a great example of this in the Bible, and we're going to be looking at the character traits of a guy named Daniel as we kind of go through a little bit of that book and look at his character traits that enabled him to endure 70 years as a prisoner and still follow God and in the midst of those 70 years, make a phenomenal impact on in his generation, and along with the book of Revelation, have phenomenal impact on our generation. God honors those who honor him in the turbulent times. Big, big deal. Because those are the easiest times to fall away. But if I honor God in the times of calm, and I practice my disciplines in the time of calm, in the time of turbulence, I have something to pull out from within me. It's the best, and it's the most, probably one of the most powerful things I can ever tell you from this pulpit in the daily functioning of your life. So, this guy Daniel lived over 2,600 years ago. He had turbulent times. Hey, you know what? Every time throughout history is turbulent. How many know that? Sometimes we think, oh my God, we're in the worst time. Yeah, we're getting closer to the end. But you know what? Whether we get to the end of before the Lord comes back or whether we don't, we're getting to the end, at least of our existence here. And there will be times of turbulence and times of calmness in each one of our lives. And each of them are valuable. When we go south, when we're in a turbulent time, God has to step in and redeem and restore. When we honor God in turbulent times, God honors us, and we become blessed in ways we would never know or imagine without having to go through that experience. And it's the truth. So I'm going to give you a little history because context is everything, as I've been sharing with you. Everybody lives in a context. The context of your life is the context of your life. You make decisions based on that context. So when we understand the context of a situation, we get a broader and a deeper understanding of what people go through and how they handle it, good, bad, and indifferent. So in this guy Daniel, he grew up in about 700 B.C., actually a little bit later than that. And by the way, when I speak of B.C., it's descending numbers, because we're heading toward zero, so we get to A.D. So we'll start at about 750 B.C., and we'll start to move down in numbers. And about in the time of this period, 750 to 626 B.C., 100 and some odd years, the world was ruled by a country called Assyria. Assyria would be somewhere near the Assyrians would be somewhere near Assyria in our day and age. These guys were vicious and cruel. These guys were the people that were saddled with the idea. They invented crucifixion. They knew how to torture. And if you were against them and rebelled against their leadership, they could torture you like no other. They were cruel. In fact, the Assyrians were the people that God told Jonah during this period of time to go to these guys, go to their capital city called Nineveh, and tell them to repent of their atrocities, or I will come and judge them. And that's when Jonah, in the book of Jonah, says, I ain't going over there. He goes, let me give you a little history, God, because we always like to give God the bigger picture. He goes, they have been really bad to us. Really, really bad. If you're going to burn them, I will bring the kindling. I will help you. I hate them. They're no good. And God said, oh, well, okay, Jonah, you do it your way. No, he didn't. He said, Jonah, you're going one way or the other. And in your case, Jonah, it's going to be the other. So you're going. And so that's a little bit of a picture of what took place. Now, about 626 BC, after the Assyrians had been running the world for about 150 years, a guy named Nabopolassar of Babylonia, which we would call Iraq now, this is all taking place in the Middle East, rose to power among his own people and finally was able to conquer the Assyrians and push them out of his country. And ultimately, they became the next dominant power called the Babylonians. So they basically lived in Iraq. Well, his dad ruled the world for the next 20 years or so. And then in 206 BC, he dies. And his oldest boy, Nebuchadnezzar, everybody follow me? Key thing here is get the names right, because I will be testing. There's a form before you can leave this place. You got to get all the names right. And I'm giving you the wrong pronunciation on purpose so you'll fail the test, so I'll look good. It's an old ploy I used. No, but you can look all this stuff up. You may think, "Guy Joe, you know a lot of stuff." Hey, I've been studying this stuff for 25 years. I should know a little bit about it. It's my job, right? You all have your job. It'd be amazing if you're a plumber and you're unfamiliar with piping. And so don't be too impressed. So this guy takes over. He gives it to his son. His son's name's Nebuchadnezzar. And Nebuchadnezzar either has a dream or one day he's praying to his god, a god named Marduk, he came to be known as Bel, which was their chief god. They had multiple idols. And he was praying, and he believed this god told him to take over the world. He was given permission, and his god would back him up. So he started a policy of imperialistic expansion. So the first country he attacks is Egypt, and he conquers Egypt. And then from Egypt, he moves to Israel, back then it was called Judah. And he besieges Jerusalem, which means he, kind of like what America has done to North Korea, put an embargo around them so no goods can come in and nobody can get out, so you starve them out. You move them to your will economically. So he did that to Jerusalem. And the king of Jerusalem was a guy named Jehoiakim, and he was a bad king. He was not a good dude. And he conquered this king to where the king finally says, "We give up." So we pick up the story in Daniel chapter 1 to where the winners, they haven't destroyed the city, and I guess I should tell you this. There'll be three times in the next 20 years or so that the Babylonians attack Judah. This time they just conquered the king, they left him in place, and they said, "You better pay a lot of gold every year. You better pay a lot of tribute to us, and we'll let you rule yourself in autonomy." Next time they come in, they get rid of him, and they destroy a bunch of the place. And the last time, they completely destroy Jerusalem, and they rule that country for the next 70 or so years. But this is the first attack. So they go in, and what they immediately do, and we'll see this in the scripture here in a minute, they go and they go to the temple. They go to the Jewish temple, and they take a bunch of stuff. Why? They show their God that my God, Marduk, is more powerful than your God. So we take his stuff and we take it back to Babylon and we put it in the temple of our God. So let's pick up the story. Everybody with me on this? Context is everything, so stay with me. Somebody wake up that guy right there. Just kidding. Everybody looked. Everybody, a number of people turned and looked. Hey, don't worry. His name's Neil. All right. It says, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. Did exactly what I told you. And the Lord, Jehovah, so our God, delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God, and these he carried off to a temple of his God in Babylonia and put in the treasure house of his God. It was a show of display that my God's better. And the reason you need to understand this is, much like the Muslim world of today, religion and politics are one. That's why there's this thing of Sharia law and the whole ISIS and Taliban and all that stuff. They are trying to run their government by religious law. For us in America, that's not how we do it. But still in much of the Middle East, religion and politics are one and the same. What the religion says, the politicians carry out. So This guy did that. So he takes it over and says, our God's stronger and we will rule the world. And Jehoiakim, you can still stay as king, but you're my puppet and you need to pay tribute. But not only did he take stuff, he did something else. This Nebuchadnezzar is a brilliant leader. In the conquering of the lands, and he would conquer more, he would leave oftentimes the government in place, but they would be under his control, and he would charge them a bunch of money every year they would have to pay. But he would also do one other thing. He would take some of their kids and some of the nobility, and he would take them back to Babylon, and he would put them in his palace, and they would become known as what we currently call royal hostages. They were an insurance policy against this nation rebelling. Because if you rebel, King Jehoiakim, hey, you know your family? Yeah, we're going to kill them. And we're going to kill the other nobles' families. And so it was an insurance policy to keep these nations from actually rebelling. But not only that, these people that they would take were the wealthy leaders and up-and-coming leaders of their nation. So they were well-educated. They were familiar with the culture of their country of origin. They were familiar with the laws and the rules and the way it operated. They knew the language. They understood their history. They were very religious, at least in upbringing. They followed the law of the land in every way. They were smart and talented. One is this would help Nebuchadnezzar to know about the people he governed. He would know their ways. He would know what was best to deal with them. He would know what their worldview is and how they would look at things so that he could use them to help him. And then secondly, he could indoctrinate them with the Babylonian way of life, so that they would begin to see a different way of living and recognize that Marduk is more powerful than their religious god, that the Babylonians were politically and militarily more powerful, and they would hopefully be swayed into the Babylonian way of life so they could also export that to the next generation of the land they were conquering. So there was multiple reasons for not only taking the stuff and being religiously over them, it was prudent to take the leader's children and those growing up, because Daniel, and if you ever heard of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, his three buddies, these four guys, which the book of Daniel speaks of numerous times, they were young. They believed they were anywhere from 13 to 18 years old. So they were going from a time of prosperity and being at the top of the heap as nobility and people that were positioned to carry forth the ways of Judah into the future, to being foreigners and prisoners with no family around. They entered into a great turbulent time, not even knowing they'd never become free again in their lifetime, most of them, with the idea that death was always hanging over their heads if somebody from their home country didn't play fair or play by the rules that Nebuchadnezzar set. So these guys were going into their world of pain. And so in order for them to be courageous, they had to recall what they learned in the good times and actually believe it. You know, some of you, Teresa and I have been approached numerous times, and people, basic comments they make about our loss of our daughter a couple months ago was, I don't know how you guys do it. I don't know how you do it. All we do is try to be courageous. And this is the truth. God's word in me is a settled thing. I know he's in charge. I know it doesn't mitigate the tears, doesn't mitigate the loss, doesn't mitigate the pain. But I know he's in charge. I know we win. I know he's got a plan. And I know that because I believed it when in the good times. I was sharing with Chris earlier in back office. If you're new here, you probably don't know, but my daughter died 4 months ago, and my son died 6 years ago. And we have been rocked to the core of our lives. And we have one daughter that's still on this side of heaven. And so I had a point. I was talking to Chris. That's why we're in this together. You leave me on my own, we're in deep trouble. Thank you, people. And yeah, I did that on purpose, just to see who was listening. So I was telling Chris in the back, you know, I remember years ago, I probably was 8, 10 years, and Teresa knows this, but when I was 8, 10 years into the Lord, I was thinking to myself one day, I'm laying in bed thinking this, I said, what would it take for me to bail on my faith? I don't know if you've ever asked yourself that. My suggestion is don't. But I foolishly did. I asked God, what would it take? And then I even said it. If God took one of my kids, would I still walk with God? Would I still follow God? What would it take for me to say this is enough and there ain't no more? And it come to find out, I can. I can walk with God. With facing, you know, going through what I would consider the most devastating thing that could happen, especially for a parent. But see, I had those thoughts in the calm time, in the early time, when I had the choices to go sideways, to do this, in the times of prosperity, because it's in the times of prosperity that we cheat. It is in the times of prosperity where our character is developed. It's way easier for me to be not self-disciplined in times of prosperity. What's a little bit here, what's a little bit there of whatever it little bit is. It's easier. But the problem is when you get in the times of turbulence and you need to call on that, you haven't trained yourself in it. I was talking to my son the other day, my grandson. He's a freshman, and this guy... I got to brag on him a little bit. He just got all-league first team in track for his conference. He's a freshman in high school. Yeah. I'm a brilliant teacher. I know nothing about track. I go, what are they doing? I have learned this about track. It's all day long. It just never ends. Event after event after event. But this year he also played football, and he was really good. But now he's in spring training for varsity. They brought him up for the playoffs, but now he's in spring training for varsity. And he was telling me the other day, I was asking him, how's it going? He's going, Pops, I'm learning to key off the guard. I said, in freshman football, we never did that. I just played my position. But he goes, now I'm learning that when the guard moves a particular way, he's a linebacker, I move this way. I read what's going on, what they're trying to do. See, he's had to learn now in the easy time, spring training, where he's practicing in the time of prosperity. Nobody's even hitting them. They don't even wear helmets. They're just going there, they're working out, and they're lifting weights, and they're running, and they're doing all stuff. But this is the easy time. If he didn't learn these things and more in the easy time, when he gets into the turbulent time of a game, he'll have nothing to pull on. Or if he sleeps through the easy time and says, I don't need to go to every practice, it's boring, you know, and all that kind of stuff, because he would suffer when he would need it, because it isn't a part of him. It would be foreign to him. You guys understand what I'm saying? You take that to any other aspect of life, it's the same thing. It's the same thing. So as we carry on, it says, then the king, verse 3, then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of the court officials. So a little while after they capture the city of Jerusalem, get the king, get some of these nobility people that I've been telling you, these royal hostages, the king says, hey, you, chief Ashpenaz, you who are in charge of these hostages, bring in some. I want to check these dudes out. I want to see what we got. But there's a criteria I'm looking for. If I'm going to train them, if they're going to be used by me, if they're going to be in my advisory committee, they have to meet certain standards that are already applicable in their lives, even though they're young. And he gave them some criteria who he wants to look at. He says, listen, bring in some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobilities, the ones I've captured, some of them. He says, here's the ones I want to look at in verse 4. I want young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed and quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He says, listen, I want you to bring in some guys that we've imprisoned who have some character traits already displayed in their lives. Well, what are these character traits? First one is no physical defect. This is the only time in all history where being normal is a problem. Because anybody that was crippled or a leper or lame or couldn't see, they got to stay home. Finally, being a leper pays off. Finally, being blind is a good thing. It's like these guys had no physical defects. So they checked them out, the nobility of the guys that were the best bodies. So this goes to tell you something right here. That's a God thing right there. Your body is what God has given you. You don't get to choose it, but you are responsible to take care of it. He said, without physical defect, people that can function, he says. They got a proven thing. And then he adds another character trait, that are handsome. You know what handsome entitles? Self-care. Take people who take care of themselves. Why? Because you got to be courageous to do that. And that requires self-discipline. See, if you're not disciplined just with your own body in the times of prosperity, how is your body going to respond when it comes under the stress of turbulence? If your body is already stressed all the time because you don't take care of it when normal life is happening, when your heart's pumping as hard as it can because I haven't exercised, I haven't taken care of my heart during the normal times, how is it going to handle the other burden when you're emotionally wrecked? Not well. It's a problem. And it's a problem that is way more difficult to handle under a stressful time. Because when we're under stress, we want to eat or we don't want to eat. After we came back from Texas, my brother was telling me this just the other day. We were up in the mountains with him with the little kids and had a boat, and it was our daughter's birthday last weekend. So it was, you know, we needed to do something with the kids. So we're up there, and he says, Joe, man, the family was super worried about you when they saw what you looked like when you came back from Texas. And I said, what do you mean? I lost 15 pounds. Something was working. He goes, no, man, you look sucked up. And it was like, I had no idea. And you know what that did? That immediately triggered in me, I got to get back to the gym. I got to start taking care of myself again. Because I've been working out consistently for years. And that's a deep ingrained part of my being. And I recognize that in that loss and in that pain, the stress of it all, I didn't want to eat. It wasn't like I was on some diet. I didn't want to eat. And if anybody's ever been in loss and grief, you're not hungry. You're not hungry. But I knew, and it had been put in me, that I can't stay this way. And I already knew all the exercises and all the things I needed to reincorporate into my life. Not because it was a new thing for Joe, and now I got to add this onto my life with all the other troubles I got going on. I haven't lived it. I have already made it a part of my life. It was a regular and is a regular part of my life. So now I'm just got to, when I'm in that stressful bit, I go back to that and I start the discipline again. I can do this in this. I cannot allow myself to keep sinking down. That's how we deal with stuff. We say, okay, I know what to do here. So he said, listen, the first two things Nebuchadnezzar says to this chief guy and bringing in these odds, bring in the guys that are physically able and handsome. They know how to take care of themselves. Because why? Because we're going to dump a bunch of stuff they don't even know about. They're already super stressed. Their whole world has been changed. They went from somebody to nobody. They went from being somebody to foreigners, to immigrants. Don't know the language, don't know the culture, don't know nothing, and are despised by the people considered less than because they're conquered. Not only that, so they're already dealing with that major stress, and now we're going to put them through 3 years of rigorous training in the ways of the Babylonians. So they already need to show that they can handle life well when they had it going on. Is everybody following me on this? Then the third thing he tells them is this. They need to show aptitude for every kind of learning. He says they need to have a capacity to learn more. Same thing in our lives. If you're married, what book have you read lately about marriage? What have you done to help yourself become a better spouse? If you're single, what have you read about being single? What have you looked at? What have you watched and how to live as a single person better? What are you doing to increase your capacity to do well at where you're at? He says, let me look at these guys. What is their capacity for learning? What have they already learned? What are they hungry to learn more? Everything you have learned has got you to this point. This is not enough to take you farther. You have to be a learner, a student of going on. If all the scripture you get during the week is what we put up there on the screen, you're going to be in trouble. You'll have no well to dig in. Parenting, how many know that? Isn't it cute when new parents tell you how their parenting is going to go? So cute. And the first kid, when somebody came in that had a newborn, their first newborn, they didn't leave the house for 3 months. They're not going to get a little Johnny sick. Second kid, they're in here 5 days after it's born. They all get sick. Because you learn, you know, we think we're going to change. Oh, you know, I got kids, I'm going to teach the world how to parent. My mom and dad did it wrong. Well, you're here. Hey, it looks like they at least fed you, right? You made it some. I know, nobody's got perfect parents. Nobody. I thought we did it all right. In fact, that was one of my disillusionments with Christianity. My kids only knew Christianity. They didn't know Joe's crazy life. Then they get to a certain age and they go sideways. I didn't know that was norm for pastors' kids. It's like, somebody should have told me that when I started trying to be a pastor. I might have had a little influence on me. I thought if we did this, and added six more Christian things, I'd have mooey Christian kids. Then reality hit. It was like, well, what? Oh, God. Hello, we did it your way. He goes, Joe, you did it your way. And you did most of it out of fear. And fear is never a good foundation to build anything on. Conviction's a great foundation. Fear, not so much. So he said, listen, they need to have an aptitude, a capacity to grow and a desire to do that. And then the next thing he tells them this, they need to be well-informed. They need to know more. I've known Christians that say, don't read anything secular. Don't read anything that's outside of our little bubble here because, you know, that'll influence you away from God. You mean my God's that weak? He can't battle somebody's opinion? He can't. And you mean God's put all this knowledge into different people's lives and all these disciplines into how to do life and insights into living, and I'm not supposed to gather any of that because it's not Christian? Well, I'm pretty sure there's a lot of construction people that aren't Christian, yet I trust them to build my house. Yet I get in the cars they make. I didn't do a biography on anybody. Oh, could you tell me who exactly worked on this car? And where they were at in their faith? Right? Hey, I'll tell you what, too. I've worked with Christians that are, don't tell anybody you're a Christian. You're ruining it for everybody. Your testimony, we're going to keep that on the down low. Right? Am I getting too honest up here, or is this? All right. Glad I picked that bone. He says, listen, well-informed, the ability to understand things. And then the last one he says, and quick to understand. Quick to understand has the idea of being able to grasp a bigger picture. When you can grasp a bigger picture, you can be courageous. When you are well-informed, knowledge is power. You can be more courageous. When you know that you're not the first one to travel any path you're on, you're not the first one. None of us in here are blazing the first trail in any area of life. So that means other people have walked it before you. Well-informed means grab onto them, the successful ones. Don't get a whole bunch of input from people who don't know. Then it's all theory. When I deal with with things in my life, I want people that have traveled the road. Because if they haven't traveled the road, they're just with you. It's all theory to them. I don't know. Try that. Let me know how it goes. That's why we need people that are farther ahead of us, and we need people behind us, because everyone in here has something to give. There's somebody behind you. And you're not traveling the journey alone. That means you need help. Well-informed. Well-informed. There's more knowledge out there. That's helpful. See, when we try to become less informed, when we shrink back, what tends to happen is the world misses out on our gifts. You have gifts to give. You have something to give. Yeah, but I've got all. No, you still got something to give. And there's help for you to navigate this successfully. You're going to need courage. Because some of us, one of the biggest courageous steps we're going to make is to ask for help. That's a big step to make. Some of us are going to have to overcome rejection. Believe me, you're going to get rejected. Not everybody thinks you're the cat's meow. Some of us don't even think we're the cat. We're the cat and we don't even like the cat. She barked. Quick to understand, an understanding of the bigger picture, an understanding that there's more going on than what I see. There's more happening. So that saves me from getting caught in the moment-to-moment aspects of life and making the latest thing I'm in the biggest thing ever. And you know what? When you face great tragedy, you learn it to a much greater degree, great turbulence. You learn a much greater degree that there are small turbulences. When you how many of us lived, everything was turbulent. And they were all 10s. On a scale of 1 to 10, they're all 11s. Everything's 11. It's like, you know what? You get enough 10s, you go, you know what? There are 2s. There are 1s, and there's a lot of 5s. And you know what? Most of, it's a curve. I don't have to get crazy over everything. Not that big a deal. And then you begin to handle life more consistently. If I can handle when I'm walking with the people, then when I have to run with the horses, I understand the difference. And then I can rely on what has got me this far, and then I learn more in that. And he says this, and qualified, you have checked out their reputation so they can come into the king's service. So whatever time you're in right now, one, God is qualifying you. There's also aspects that he wants you to deal with character-wise so that you can be used in a greater way. Where you're at right now is a, you know, there is, it's a non-turbulent time in one way. You need to be practicing what you need to practice. Now, you need to be doing right. If your prayer life sucks in the good times, it's not all of a sudden going to get solid in the bad times. It's going to get crazy in the bad. Oh, God! Why me? Why not you? You're a human being. I know in my life, there's nothing that I'm exempt from that any other human being goes through. I will not go through everything you go through. You will not go through everything I go through, but you will go through what you will go through, and I'll go through what I go through. My job is to handle it well. That means I got to continue to learn. I've got to continue to grow. I had a guy the other day, first time coming to church. I love those guys when they tell you what you need to do, but I hate it when they're right. Last time I spoke, I went over by about 8 minutes. He said like 12, but right off the bat, I knew he was a liar. I got to make this fast. He came up to me and goes, "Hey, I really appreciate your service. It was really cool and all that." And I go, "Oh, thanks, man. I'm glad you're here," and yada, yada. And he goes, "Hey, but you know what? Listen, when you say it's going to end, you should end it, because after that point in time, me and I'm sure a lot of other people check out." It's like, but you know what? He's right. He's right. So I'm going to cut it down to like 3 minutes over. So why don't we stand up? Oh, God, it's rough being a God, kid of God. So here's the deal, you guys. You're at where you're at in whatever you're at this point of the journey. If you're in a calm time, you need to practice what you know is the right thing to do, because you will hit a time when the practice you have put in will have to be played in the game that God has you in. Practice well. Some of you are in the game and it's turbulent and you're being tossed to and fro. Remember, it's a lifelong game. So you will get opportunity to relearn, to be restored, to be redeemed, to learn in the turbulence what you need to practice in the calm, because all storms end at some point. You may have, you know, there are some you'll carry for the rest of your life, like loss and perhaps a disease or some other things like that. And in the midst of them, God will teach you how to learn. He will bandage you up, just like players in a game. Sometimes they're playing with a tweak in their hamstring and they get all the wrapping they need and they go out and play, and that's what they got to deal with. But oftentimes, the turbulent thing will last for so long, and then you need to have learned where you're weak in the game, where courage lacked, so that when you get in the calm, you can apply the practice to build that area. Does everybody understand what I'm saying? So let's just close our eyes for a second. God, I just pray that you would reveal to us, if you haven't already, some areas in our life that we don't really practice thinking it's not a big deal. God, I pray that you will make us quick to understand, that we would all leave here today a little bit quicker to understand that those times count. Those are practice times. So God, as you've revealed that, we just raise our hand right now. Raise a hand. God, I ask you. Can you repeat after me? God, I ask you. Help me to achieve courage in this area where I lack it. Courage to do the right thing. Courage to practice the right practice, so that I may be honorable and that you would honor me for that honorableness. Amen. That was weird. All right, God bless you guys. Have a great day.